So I think there aren't too many people who are here for the last marathon session last week. So I'm not going to assume that. So last week in the 17th part of the talk, I talked a little bit about. About things that are going to have some overlap with what I'm talking about now, although what I talked about before was sort of more generally formal, and I'll talk about and I'll illustrate with more examples. But again, in the spirit of these very informal discussions, I want to have a mixture of both the actual concrete things that you can take away and fit in your head, but also a sort of picture of what at least I myself find to be the most, or at least one of the most striking things that we've been learning about scattering amplitudes in gauge theories. I might say a very tiny bit about gravity at the end. I mean, Zvi has already talked about gravity a bit, but maybe I'll just say a few other small things about it, because as I'm sure Zvi emphasized, I certainly strongly believe that there's vastly more magic in gravity amplitudes than there are in Yang-Mills amplitudes, which is a mind-blowing statement, because Yang-Mills amplitudes are already mind-blowingly rich and have structures and properties you'd never dream of. But gravity amplitudes are going to be even more spectacular than Yang-Mills amplitudes. And I want to tell you how pathetic the state of the art is, other than in a direction a little bit orthogonal to what Zvi has been doing. Certainly not pathetic. I mean, but in a specific sense, I want to, because this is also an area I think. It's really ripe for someone to sit down. I mean, I've been saying I should do it myself for a while, but it's ripe for someone to sit down for a month and think hard, and some spectacular breakthroughs are easily possible. I should say that Andrew Hodges has been thinking about gravity for a year, and is going to have something to say in the next month or so, which I suspect is going to be very, very interesting from what I've seen so far. But anyway, so I'll say a few things about gravity. But mostly it'll be about Yang-Mills. And I think, to me, one of the most surprising things about the Yang-Mills story is how incredibly combinatorial scattering amplitudes end up being. Okay? We normally think about amplitudes as being, well, they are. They're functions of momenta, they and helicities, and so on. But this, there is an evolving picture where all of the action actually has very little to do with the specific numerical values or analytic formulas for the amplitudes. It's really some algebraic geometric picture underlying it. You notice this most vividly when you actually work on the subject. At least most of my time is spent drawing polygons and drawing pictures of various intersecting lines and planes, and so on. And somehow there's an incredibly geometric, algebraic geometric, combinatorial picture underlying it. And actually, computing the amplitude is something done at the very, very, very end. All the relations. And all the many of the remarkable properties that the amplitudes have are seen as incredibly simple, but very rich in structure, algebraic geometric objects. So that's a theme that I want to develop in this last lecture. And I want to do it by starting with an example where we understand things sort of forwards and backwards. And then tell you a little bit more about some of the other things that are known. In a sort of nutshell, a general picture that's there for all leading singularities, first of all, and as a consequence also for all tree amplitudes, is that these objects are associated with some polytopes. in some abstract space. Actually, in the case we understand very well, the polytope is actually in the Grassmannian itself, although I won't assume you know anything about that for those of you who weren't there for the 5-hour session. But it's a rough picture to keep in mind, that the amplitudes are the volumes of something. If you want to compute this volume, you have to take this funny thing and break it up into triangles, break it up into elementary simplices. And different ways of breaking this object up into elementary simplices gives different representations of the amplitude that make different physical properties manifest. Some of those representations make unitarity manifest. Some of the representations make locality manifest. Other representations make, some of these representations make the infinite dimensional symmetries, the conformal and the dual conformal invariants at the same time manifest. But it's a very striking picture, which is at its heart deeply combinatorial. And things like locality and unitarity are reflected in the ways these polytopes are put together and the ways they can be decomposed into simpler parts. Okay, so there, that's something which, at least as the ideology that I advocated, or at least I presented in the first part of these lectures, that we should be looking for some picture for what the amplitudes are, where locality and unitarity are outputs and are seem to be consequences of some more basic rules. We really seem to be seeing, at least in a very concrete form, what some elements of these more basic rules might actually be. So that's why I think this subject has, and this particular point of view about it has I think, wide interest beyond people who really, really like to calculate these amplitudes. I should also say that another very big development that's going with great steam in the past number of months is starting to learn how to actually, at loop level, not just talk about the integrands, which is more or less under control, but to learn how to actually do the integrals. And this is another place where you could have thought for years and years there was some clue of some very, very basic combinatorial structure at work. As Mark probably discussed in his last lecture, when you compute amplitudes, at one loop you get dye logarithms, at two loops you get more complicated polylogarithms, and so on. And dye logs and polylogs, these are not random special functions. These are an extraordinarily special and interesting set of special functions that have a very deeply combinatorial character to them. The reason why a lot of mathematicians are so interested in polylogs is not because they're in love with the sum of z to the n over n to the p, but because these set of functions turn out to have lots of relationships to number theories, to Galois theory, to all sorts of other very basic, non-smooth, very combinatorial things. And that's just a very striking fact, that you calculate the amplitudes and you get these very peculiar and fascinating set of special functions. And while this part of the story is less well developed, I think there's every reason to suspect that the properties of these polylogarithms are descending from and are reflecting this underlying combinatorial structure that we're seeing already at tree level in the leading singularities in the integrand. So the sort of fantasy is that that once we really understand things, we'll never touch an integral. We'll stare at an integrand. We'll perform some symbolic manipulations on it, and we'll write down the polylogarithmic answers that go along with them. Minimally, we'll write down what Mark probably defined as the symbol of the polylogs, which is the sort of most invariant content of them, should arise from a completely symbolic manipulation with no integral sign ever touched. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about. Is this very combinatorial property of scattering amplitudes. But I want to start with a very concrete example, just so you also see what some of these, some concrete scattering amplitudes look like. In my previous lectures, I introduced momentum twister variables. Let me very, very quickly remind you of what these are. So if we have, so first of all, and this is largely for convenience, we should be able to do all these things either in ordinary space-time or this dual space-time. Just for many practical reasons, it's turned out to be easier to see these things, at least in the beginning, in the dual space-time. So remember, we have this picture where we have the polygon made out of the light-like momenta of the external particles. Because of cyclicity, they are ordered, and so I can write each momentum as an xa plus 1 minus xa. So these x's are the corners of this polygon. And we learned this basic correspondence that if we want to talk about conformal symmetry in general, in any space, in any Minkowski space, in particular this dual conformal symmetry in this dual Minkowski space, it's useful to use twister variables. Twister variables associate a line in space-time with a point in twister space. Satisfying this equation. So all the x's that satisfy that equation, that's twister space. If I give you a mu and a lambda, all the x's that satisfy that equation lie on a line. And since I can rescale this equation by any constant factor, I really associate a line in space-time with a point z, which is in projective three-space rather than four-dimensional space. So that's the most basic part of the correspondence. The second part of the correspondence is that if you have a line in twister space, for example, made by passing through two points A and B, then associated with that is a point in space-time, and that point has coordinates just as the intersection of the two null rays corresponding to mu A and to mu B. And it's the same point if you slide these A and B anywhere along this line, so it's actually associated with a line. So that's a line in twister space is a point in space-time and vice versa. And that finally gave us these very beautiful variables with which we could talk about, the external data. In a way that was acted on nicely by conformal transformations, and also gave us the nicest unconstrained set of variables with which to talk about the external kinematics. One simply draws the analogous picture in twister space. Every point in this picture becomes a line in the twister space. Oh, and I should have also said that let's say you take this formula and you take two lines corresponding to the points x and y. If we compute the invariant distance between x and y, then it ends up being a, b, c, d over lambda a, lambda b, lambda c, lambda d. That's a very simple exercise that you can do just taking this equation. If I give you a line AB and some other line CD, so these correspond to two points X and Y, that going with AB, that going with CD, and you can sort of compute the invariant distance between X and Y squared, and you find this expression, this for bracket is going to make an appearance over and over again in this lecture, and is what you get just by contracting all the z's together with the epsilon symbol. So as long as you have conformal symmetry, the only invariant tensor is the epsilon tensor, and geometry is projective geometry. There's no notion of length, nothing. Okay? However, x minus y squared is not conformally invariant. The distance is obviously not conformally invariant. And so you see what appears in this formula downstairs are things which do not respect the SL4 symmetry. If I just contract the two top components of this 4 vector, that clearly doesn't respect this, the SL4 symmetry. In fact, if you allow yourselves only to contract lambdas or mu's with each other as well, then that reduces the SL4 symmetry down to the Poincaré group. Okay? And said a little bit more, fancily, we can introduce something that you might call, something that is called the, so if the z's have SL4 coordinates zi, you can introduce something that's often called the infinity twister I, which is an anti-symmetric matrix, an anti-symmetric 4x4 matrix with vanishing determinant. So epsilon ij kl ij ik, whatever, epsilon ii is equal to 0. So I is like something like epsilon 0, 0, 0, for example. Okay. And so so lambda a, lambda b, would then just be ZA contracted with this I ZB. Okay. Now it's called an infinity twister for a good reason. Notice that any line at all can also be thought of, see it's quadratic in the ZA and the ZB. It's anti-symmetric in the two indices. So any line in twister space at all is associated with some anti-symmetric 4x4 matrix. And in fact, it squares to zero. It has vanishing determinant. Okay? So the infinity twister is actually just some special preferred line in twister space. Okay? So that's all we're saying. We're saying if the theory is conformally invariant, there's no special lines anywhere in this three-dimensional projective space. To break conformal invariance, all you need to do is specify one special line in twister space. Okay? So one special line, I, is a special line. Now the special line in twister space corresponds to a special point in space-time. And who is that special point? The name gives it away. It's the infinity twister. It's the point at infinity. Okay? So Minkowski space, in order to have conformal symmetries acting nicely on it, Minkowski space has an origin. Inversions take the origin to infinity. So in order for conformal invariance to act nicely on Minkowski space, you have to add the point at infinity. You add the point at infinity, and that conformally compactifies Minkowski space, just like adding the point at infinity on the Riemann sphere gives you to the complex plane gives you the nice Riemann sphere. Okay? So when the theory is conformally invariant, you don't know there's something special about the point at infinity. The point at infinity is no different than any other point. But specifying a point at infinity is precisely the data that breaks the conformal group down to Poincaré. Right? All right, so that's just some twister terminology. So you see here that x minus y squared, which is not conformally invariant, is proportional to something which is conformally invariant, ABCD, but it couldn't have been equal to ABCD. That has weight under rescaling A, B, C, and D. Something had to eat up those weights. And so the thing that eats it up is lambda A, lambda B, lambda C, lambda D, or said more fancily, the infinity twisters downstairs, A, I, B, C, I, D. So this has vanishing weight, as does x minus y squared, obviously. All right, so that's a nice formula, which also tells you something. It tells you that when AB, when the line AB intersects the line CD, or said another way, when the points ABCD are all coplanar, these two lines are coplanar, means that they intersect each other, then x minus y squared vanishes. Okay, and that's good, because while general separation isn't conformally invariant, when they're null separated, it is conformally invariant. And so the points being null separated in space-time must mean something conformally, projectively invariant in Twister space. The only possible conformal invariant relationship two lines can have is whether they intersect or not. So if they intersect, the corresponding points are null separated. Okay. So that's why we can draw this picture. Okay? Associated with each point here in the space-time is one of these null lines. And the fact that one point is null separated from the next means that one line intersects the next, and so on. Okay? That's what the picture looks like in Twister space. And so we can beautifully give all this data just by specifying the intersection points. If I just hand you a bunch of random z1, z2, z3 up to zn, I just hand you this data, you can rebuild the lines, and from that reconstruct the points in that picture, and from that reconstruct the momenta. So giving you completely unconstrained z's, from them you can build lambdas and lambda tildes that are guaranteed to be to satisfy momentum conservation. In other words, there's completely unconstrained variables that give you null vectors that satisfy momentum conservation. And you can do this exercise yourself. It's a very simple exercise. All the formulas are given on the board, everything you need. And very concretely, the lambdas are the lambdas, but the lambda tildes are given in terms of this pretty formula, in terms of the mu's. Even if I didn't tell you anything else, I just handed you that formula, you would then go check magically that, hey, yeah, wow, that these lambdas and lambda tildes automatically satisfy momentum conservation. And the fact that they do is a simple consequence of the Schouten identity that you can check yourself. Okay. A final thing is that associated with these variables, we also have, we do exactly the same thing with the Grassmann variables. So there's a, you might call it a phi A, and the phi A are given by exactly the same formula as a combination of, the eta tildes are given by very similar formula in terms of the phis. So that we specify momentum super twister components lambda A, mu A, and phi A, and specifying these suffices to give you data that satisfies momentum conservation and supermomentum conservation. Okay? And of course, as a bonus, the dual conformal symmetries act beautifully on this object, just as SL4, or the supersymmetric version of SL4, SL4/4. Okay. So that was a lightning review of the kinematics, so we're back on the same page. So I want to remember this formula. Let me write it down. All right. Okay. So now let's start talking about some of the actual amplitudes beyond kinematics. One thing I mentioned last time. Let me just jump into it right away, because we'll be dealing with the simplest version in a second. But let me just say something. Let me remind you of a general object that I mentioned a couple of times, which is this contour integral over the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions. Let me write that as d. Actually, in this lecture, k is the k of n to the k MHV. So k equals 0 is MHV, k equals 1 is NMHV, and so on. All right. So this is an integral over the space of k planes and n dimensions. I won't go back through it in detail. We'll just immediately go to the very simplest case. But I just want to remind you that this is supposed to be an object which is to be thought of as a contour integral. If thought of as a multidimensional contour integral, you can compute all of its residues. And the mathematical fact is that its residues generate all the invariants, all objects that are invariant under both conformal and dual conformal transformations. This is the sort of generating set for all of the Yangian invariants of via theory. It manages to see both conformal and dual conformal symmetry because evidently it doesn't care much about space-time at all. Okay? It's not an action or a Lagrangian or anything. It's this object. But the residues of this object are the building blocks for all the scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 to all loop order. And the all-loop recursion relation for the integrand that I told you about takes as its input the objects spat out by this contour integral and jams them together in canonical ways to produce the all-loop integrand. So these multi-loop results, effortless multi-loop results for the integrand. The leading singularities are all there, but also the integrand itself is built out of these basic objects. So it's really important to understand understand the meaning of this object in greater detail. If I have time towards the end of the lecture, I'll tell you something that we understand now, which we didn't understand 3 months ago, but we understand very well now, is the real meaning. It's the geometric meaning of this object. These funny so this D is a K by N matrix, and these 1, 2, 3 up to K is the determinant of columns 1 up to column K. So it's the minors of this K by N matrix. There's a picture now for where this object is coming from. So perhaps I'll get to that later. But just then, just to get going, so one thing that we're going to be guaranteed with by staring at this formula is that anything we do is going to be invariant under all the symmetries of the theory. Actually, let me mention something I think I quickly mentioned last time. Forget about this fancy Yangian. Let's say you just wanted to write down objects that were invariant under super conformal transformations. The important part is the super. If you just want to write down objects that are invariant under conformal transformations, that's easy to do. You just take a bunch of these bosonic vectors, you contract them with these epsilon symbols, you build appropriate ratios out of them, so all the weights cancel, you build cross ratios out of them, and those things are super are normal conformal invariant. But it turns out to be incredibly restrictive to build super conformal invariants. The super part is massively restrictive. And in fact, it's a physics theorem as much as other ones I know. I don't know exactly how rigorous it is, but there is an argument that the only superconformal invariants, all superconformal invariants, are actually integrals of this sort. With this is the part that guarantees that it's superconformal invariant. Okay? If I just stare at this object, it's totally obvious that this is superconformal invariant. It's just a linear combination of a bunch of z's, and it's a delta function of a bunch of z's. Nothing could be more obviously super conformal invariant. Just delta 4/4z. It's very important that it's supersymmetric, because when you do a general linear transformation here, if it has determinant not 1, you'll pick up a weight. Okay? And that weight is precisely canceled by the fermionic, by the Jacobian from the fermion. So it's very important that this is it's supersymmetric. But once it's supersymmetric, this is completely obviously invariant under general superlinear transformations. Nothing could be more obviously invariant. Okay? The surprise is that these are the only invariants. You can only take these objects and put them together. So this is just a general linear combination of the external z's, and all you can do is integrate over them. Now, from this point of view, you could integrate over them with any measure you like. Okay? And that's the folk theorem of the past 8 months ago, is that all superconformal invariants are integrals over the Grassmannian with some measure of this factor. This very, very special measure is what guarantees that it's not just conformal, but also dual conformal invariant. And so it enjoys the entire Yangian symmetry. Anyway, but actually, for the purposes of this of the discussion that follows, even just looking at the conformal invariants, in this case, the dual conformal invariants, because we'll also, by the way, since these things are both conformal and dual conformal invariant, and the equation is identical in both spaces, you can be doing it in any space you want. It's just a matter of convenience. The reason why we work with momentum twister variables is that the amplitudes are smooth functions of momenta. Okay? We know the amplitudes are nice smooth functions of momenta. And these momentum twister variables are just very simply, you know, trivially algebraically related to standard momentum variables. So whatever we do will be nice smooth functions of the momentum twister variables. The amplitudes in ordinary twister space are not smooth. As I showed you, they have support on lines and curves and are distributions. Actually, that's very beautiful and it's very important because the way they have support on those lines contains a huge amount of physics, how things factorize, what kind of soft limits happen, and so on and so forth. But for the purpose of actually doing computations, it's a lot more useful to actually have a smooth function. All right. Okay, so that's largely why we work with momentum twister variables. So let's now descend and look at the very simplest example of this, which is for k equals 1. Okay. K equals 1, this is a 1 by n matrix, and these are just numbers, right? So I can just call them dd1 over d1 up to ddn over dn, delta 4/4 di zi, or da zi. All right. So already here we see many of the important issues. First of all, this thing has a GLK invariant, so we have to mod out by the volume of GLK. In practice, that just means that let's see it concretely in this example. Here you have to mod out by GL1. Now the GL1 in this case is just what rescales all the d's by some constant. So modding out by GL1 means that I can take any one of the d's I want and put it to 1. We can go through a Fedayev-Popov argument if you want, but that's all it does. It just sets one of the d's to 1. Set any one that you want to 1. Okay? Now, as usual, putting one of these things to 1 is going to cover part of the space. Right? It's like any projective space. It's like when you talk about the complex plane, you have the normal z variables cover the southern hemisphere, but to also cover the point at infinity, you have to change variables to variables that are well suited to the northern hemisphere. So in exactly the same way, putting any one of these things to 1 allows you to work in some patch of this G1n Grassmannian. G1n, by the way, is nothing other than standard projective space. Okay, so it's the trivial case of a Grassmannian where it's just a normal projective space. So putting one of these variables to 1 is just different, just covering different patches, different hemispheres of the projective space. But let's put one of them to 1. I don't know. Let's put dn to 1. Any one of them to 1. Okay. But now you can see why this object needs to be interpreted as a contour integral. You see, this delta function is putting 4 constraints on the external data. It's 4 constraints because the z's have it's a delta 4/4. They have four variables. So I started off with n variables. One of them got taken out by the GL1. And 4 of them are going to be taken out by the delta functions. So that means that I have n minus 5 variables, integration variables, left. I have to fix these integrations somehow. And the only sensible way of doing these integrals is as a little contour integral that encircles, that puts n minus 5 of these d's to 0. So in order to get a sensible result from this, even though it's one big integral, we're now talking about many residues of this one big integral. Okay? And the many residues are obtained by setting, they're obtained by setting n minus 5 of the d's to 0. In fact, given that that's the way the residues are defined, it's clearly more convenient to label them by the five guys that are not set to 0. Okay? So that's what we'll do. Let's talk about the five guys. Let's call them A1, A2, A3, A4, A5. The five guys that are not set to 0. So all the other ones are set to 0. Because it's these trivial dds over d's, doing the residue integral is just totally trivial. It gives you 1, or 2 pi I, which is 1 in all of these lectures. Okay? We put d slashes on these things and call it a day. So let's just keep track of the ones that are not 0. So what is that? That's just going to be, and right. So that's going to be dda1 over dA1 to dda5 over dA5 delta 4 slash 4, just a single delta 4 slash 4 here now, of dA. Let me not use abstract variables here. Let's just do a specific example. Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. This is dd1 over d1 to dd5 over d5. Delta 4 slash 4 d1 z1 plus d5 z5. Okay? And I still have my gl1 that I need to take. I have to set n minus 5 to 0, and one of these things has got to be set to 0, it's got to be set to 1 by a gl1. So let's say I pick d5 and I put d5 to 1. So I just delete this, and I have the rest of them. And so the coefficient of z5 is 1. All right, now it's really straightforward to do this integral, because I can just solve for all the d's. I can solve for all the d's from the bosonic delta function there. The reason is that the bosonic delta function is telling me that, so bosonic deltas are telling me that z5 plus, or negative z5 is equal to d1 z1 plus d4 z4. Like, I can always take any four-dimensional vector and expand it in terms of four other four-dimensional vectors. Right? That's all we're doing. And I can explicitly solve for the coefficient. How would I solve the coefficients? Let's say I want to get d1. Well, let me take left and right and contract it with 2, 3, 4. So if I take 5, 2, 3, 4, this is equal to d1, 1, 2, 3, 4, and all the rest of them vanish, okay? because they're epsilon together. Okay? So that's how I solve for d1, and similarly I can solve for all the other d's. Okay? So d1 is 5, 2, 3, 4 over 1, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so I solve the d's. I remember the Jacobian from the delta function. And then that gives me a formula for, now let's return to the general, for this basic object. All of the residues of this integral are this object. Okay? That already tells you something very interesting, that all leading singularities of NMHV amplitudes are one object. Totally unobvious staring at Feynman diagrams or anything else. Okay? And in fact, they're exhausted at three loops. Beyond three loops, you don't get any new object. But anyway, we're not talking about that. Let's just talk about what it is. So what it is explicitly is a fermionic delta function phi A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, plus cyclic over A1, A2, A3, A4, A2, A3, A4, A5, A3, A4, all the consecutive four brackets. A5, A1, A4, A5, A1, A2. A5, A1, A2, A3. Okay. All right. So this is one of the most fundamental objects in this business. It's called an R invariant. Oops. I hope it's obvious where all these things come from, right? So this term just comes from the fermionic delta function, which is left. I had delta 4 is now d1 phi 1 plus d5 phi 5. The d's I just solved for them. So that's four brackets make an appearance in front of the phi's. And notice something also quite pretty, which is that I broke, you see, this is an important feature of all these integrals. The object is manifestly cyclically invariant, right? However, any way of computing it will, in intermediate parts of the calculation, break the cyclic symmetry. Here, for instance, I gauge fixed 5 to 1. Okay? And so in intermediate portions of the calculation, it was not obviously cyclically invariant. In this very simple case, it all beautifully recombines into something completely manifestly cyclically invariant. Okay?
Is there a truth of gauge fixing condition that would sort of preserve it?
No.
You can't choose some product of the DI?
No, this is this is one of the qualitatively remarkable things about the sort of BCFW world, is that we've known that amplitudes have many, many different forms that are all equivalent to each other. And part of the reason they're all equivalent is that there are different gauge presentations of some underlying object that enjoys the full symmetry. That's a theme that's played a big role in these developments, and I suspect something like that, on steroids, is what's going on in gravity. Well, I'll make some comments about that perhaps at the end when I talk a little bit about gravity. But it doesn't always work out as trivially beautifully as this. But we're just talking about this simplest case for a while. So let's just stop for a little while and enjoy this object. Okay?
How is the sign of that object defined? The contour integrals, are they all one?
No. So contour integrals, multidimensional contour integrals, do not have a well-defined sign. So in fact, the sign is associated with the order in which you put the variables to zero. And so it's a fact of life. Ordinary contour integrals don't have that property. Ordinary contour integrals are a very, very special case and have many features that don't generalize to the general case. An ordinary contour integral can be thought of as enclosing the pole. When you talk about a two-dimensional contour integral, there's nothing to enclose. It's not like a little sphere that surrounds it. That's very non-holomorphic, right? So what it really is a circle and another circle. But now you've got to talk about the order. Do you go around this way and that way, or the other way around? So residues are naturally antisymmetric objects. So when it's one-dimensional, you don't see the antisymmetry, but they're really naturally antisymmetric objects. And we really see it here. So this is an object that's beautifully antisymmetric in all of its indices. Okay? Let me say something else. So if you look at it, it's obviously dual conformal invariant. It's obviously bosonically conformal invariant, but the supersymmetry is not 100% obvious. You stare at it, I mean, you can then take the generators and act on it and so on and convince yourself that it is, but it doesn't just hit you over the face totally, blindingly obviously that it's supersymmetrically invariant. This origin makes it obvious, okay? The fact that it came from here is what makes it obvious. In this case, it's still fairly simple to see, but when you go on to the more complicated cases, if someone just handed it to you, you would not. It's not at all obvious that it's supersymmetric, but its origin makes it clear. Okay. All right. So let me stress again: to infinite loop order, okay, to any loop order, you compute something in this theory. All of its eta dependents will be these objects. They might have ridiculously complicated polylogs and more complicated things in front of them. Only these objects will sit in front of those polylogs. That's a statement that all the leading singularities are these things, which is the non-trivial conjecture, originally conjecture, now we understand it. But all the leading singularities of the theory are residues of this guy, which means, in particular, there's nothing beyond these objects. Not just the tree level, but the all loop order. All right, so now let me start getting to the more combinatorial aspect of this. You should already start seeing that there's something quite combinatorial about them. This is an object, it's completely anti-symmetric. Okay, maybe not quite yet, but we'll start seeing the combinatorics behind it now.
Anima, what do loops do in this language?
Sorry?
What do loops do in this language?
What do you mean, what do they do?
Well, you say it's true to all loop orders.
Well, what's... we can talk about the integrand, or we can talk about the whole answer. So the integrand is obtainable by recursion by taking the residues of these integrals and doing canonical operations to them. That's something I discussed a little bit last time. It won't be so important for the story I'm trying to tell today. But the important point is that regardless of whether you're talking about the integrand or the integral or anything, there is something invariant about the leading singularity. The leading singularity, either if someone hands you the integrand, is, you know, you do the integral on the contour, you compute the residue of the integrand, or if someone just hands you the answer, you recognize the leading singularities as the coefficients of the polylogs in the answer. Okay? And so this is a prediction that you go to 17 loops, the coefficients of the polylogs are always these objects and nothing new. Totally unobvious. Okay. In fact, that's one of the, if you like, I think this fact that the leading singularities are so few, there's a finite number of them, independent of loop order, is what tells you that something nice is going to happen at strong coupling. If that didn't happen, it would be, I think, impossible to imagine that as you go to 100 loops, 200 loops, if you kept getting more and more and more complicated functions sitting in front of the polylogs, it's very hard to imagine that it would resum to some beautiful thing. But that's not what happens. You get a universal set of objects, and then they get dressed by even at the level of the whole answer. Okay, they get dressed the polylogs in a way that resums nicely and goes from weak to strong coupling. Okay. All right, okay, but now let's just talk about tree amplitudes. Now, just so I can get to the good part, by the way, I mean, I'm going to be telling you in a bit that this thing is also the volume of a little tetrahedron, of a four-dimensional tetrahedron. And you should be thinking volume-y thoughts because there are all these determinants all over the place. Okay? But we'll get to that in a moment. So let me tell you what the NMHV tree amplitude is as computed by BCFW. And one of the standard ways of doing BCFW. Let me tell you what that object is in terms of these R invariants. Remember, BCFW is not manifestly cyclically invariant. It breaks the cyclic symmetry by picking two particles. Right? But this is what it looks like. It looks like the sum, this formula I wrote down a few days ago, or last time. So that's all NMHV tree amplitudes. It's just sum over all I and j from 1 to the end. So it's not manifestly cyclically invariant because it has a 1 sitting there. Okay. Let me write this object again here a little more nicely. Change notation yet again. Cyclic over A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C. Okay. So one feature is that it isn't cyclic. Let's look at another feature, which is what do the poles look like? Well, for the poles in general, we take all the possible, all the four brackets we can make out of these five objects. So this term has poles when 1i, I plus 1j goes to 0, 1i, I plus 1j plus 1 goes to 0, 1i, jj plus 1 goes to 0, 1i plus 1, jj plus 1 goes to 0, and finally, when i plus 1, jj plus 1 goes to 0. These are all the poles. Of these are crappy non-local poles. We can see why they're non-local by contrasting them with this wonderful local one. Why is that local? Well, when ii plus 1, jj plus 1 goes to 0, remember that xa was associated with the line, I think in my notation it was za, za minus 1. So ii plus 1, jj plus 1 over ii plus 1, jj plus 1 contracted by infinity twisters would then be nothing other than xi plus 1 minus xj plus 1 squared. So when ii plus 1, jj plus 1 goes to 0 is when xi plus 1 becomes not separated from xj plus 1. And these are precisely, when you draw this picture, the difference between this point and that point is just the sum of that momentum plus that momentum. The difference between that point, that one, that one, plus that one, plus that one. Okay? So this is nothing other than the sum of the pi, of the pk, from I to j with some plus or minus ones, which I can't bother to get straight right now. Okay? But just some sum of consecutive momenta from one to the other squared is going to 0. Okay? Those are the physical poles. Said another way, the physical poles are when the corners of this polygon become not separated from each other. Okay? Nothing happens when these things become not separated from each other. Okay? By the way, I've written this for totally general I and j, those would be non-local. For example, for six particles, or for five particles, they're all physical. Right? For five particles, this 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 3, 4, 5, everyone is of the form I plus 1, jj plus 1. And for six particles, only two of them are spurious and the rest of them are physical. But in general, these are, in general, the non-local poles.
The same non-local poles change when you choose a different gauge?
No. This is totally gauged. Remember, everything is gauge invariant. Everything is totally gauge independent. The only thing that can happen is, for example, I could have, I mean, it could just be that the residue you're interested in is not covered in the patch that your gauge was chosen in which case it's just not in that patch. But then you go to the appropriate patch and it's always there. Everything is perfectly gauge independent. All right, so here already we see, yes.
Is there any simple expression you can write down for some of them?
Yes. So the simple expression are the ones that Ruth wrote down and that I wrote down on the board. Okay. So
I'm saying not this one which is physical, the other ones which are not physical.
Oh no. Oh sorry. You mean the spurious ones are the ones that you're used to, but the spurious poles are the things that you're used to seeing, like 3, p4 plus p5. 6. Things like that.
This is the object there, or is
yes. No. That's exactly. It's a part of the object there, up to some angle bracket factors. That's a part of the object there, right? Okay. All right. Okay, so already now we have a very nice little thing to try and understand. We have some fascinatingly, beautifully compact expression of this amplitude, one object, okay? It's riddled with, it's not manifestly cyclic, it's riddled with spurious poles. How does it manage to be local? How do I know it's cyclic? How do I know the spurious poles cancel? Can I understand any of these things? Okay. Well, let's actually look at the simplest six-particle case to get a little clue for how this works. I just want you to notice one thing, that if I manage to prove that if I replace one by two, that these formulas were the same. In other words, if I could prove cyclic invariance, then for sure I would see that the spurious poles have to be gone, because the spurious poles are different in the second formula. The local poles are the same, but the spurious poles are different. Okay? So there have to be some very interesting identities satisfied between these objects in order to make it true. So let's just look at the first non-trivial case, which is n equals 6. Okay? Again, k equals 1, NMHV. All right, so in this case, so if I just write the terms out, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, plus 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, plus 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's just 1i plus 1, jj plus 1. In this case, just for this example, we'll return to using the standard notation. It just makes it a little bit easier to see. It makes it a little bit easier to see what's going on. Let's revert, in this case, to talking about, so remember, these are the guys that were not set to 0. So let's revert for the moment and talk about the guys that were set to 0. So in this case, the guy that was set to 0 was 6. So I can equivalently denote this residue by 6. And this one I can denote by 4. And that one I can denote by 2. Okay? That's one form of the amplitude. Now, what kind of identity is it that I'm trying to prove? Let's say I'm trying to prove that this would be the same if I cycled everything over 1. Well, that would be a different formula. If I cycled everything over by 1, I would get, instead of 2 plus 4 plus 6, I would get 1 plus 3 plus 5. And it's a very small exercise. You need to convince yourself that there are actually minus signs in front of all of these guys. Okay, so that's a little exercise related to Martin's question about the signs of the residues. I could explain it in more detail, but let me just Please believe me for now. Okay, so what we'd like to do is then prove that 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 equals 0. But this is completely obvious. Let's return to the original integral. The original integral, we have dd1 up to dd6. Over GL1, so there's a 1 over GL1, never mind him, D1 up to D6, and a delta 4/4, DAZA. So on the support of this bosonic delta function, and after the GL1, this is a one-dimensional integral, right? It's a 1D integral. Let me denote the space that it's a 1D integral, and let me just call it Z space. In Z space, this 1D integral has poles. Where are the poles? The poles where D1 vanishes. 1, 2, 3. Let me be more cunning. It has 6 poles in this complex Z plane. The tree amplitude is a sum of 1 plus 3 plus 5. Or it's a sum of 2 plus 4 plus 6 with the opposite sign. What makes them equal to each other is a contra-deformation argument, just Cauchy's theorem in this case, trivially Cauchy's theorem. Okay. So we see once again, was that obvious? Okay. Right. I hope it was. If not, please tell me. Okay. So you're starting to get a sense now that these are more interestingly combinatorial objects. They satisfy identities between each other, these nice linear identities, just in this case following from Cauchy. Okay? And it's these identities that let the different ways of putting, representing the amplitude, that let them be the same. Okay? Yes?
In terms of more practical way.
Yes.
It's a sum of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, exact momentum conservation.
No. Most certainly not. No. No, it's not momentum conservation. It's really these identities. Now, this is the most trivial case, because in this case, it happened to be a one-dimensional integral. This is really, thank God, because, this is, of course, how we bumped into this object to begin with, because after a lot of suffering, we realized that these identities could be interpreted as a contour integral. But fortunately, this was a simple case where it was a one-dimensional contour integral, so you had a prayer. More generally, there are higher-dimensional contour integrals, and it's a more interesting subject. That's what the sort of general polytope picture, Grassmannian polytope picture, is made sort of crystal clear now. But we'll see if I get to say anything about it. But for the moment, we can see that it is at least possible to prove this object is cyclic, and that it's indirectly see that it's free of spurious poles just from its cyclicity. But it follows from this interesting little fact. Okay. Now, I want to understand this even more vividly, though, and also prove it in general. This was for the six particle amplitude. So let me say what the general statement is for NMHV. Yes.
But still, there is a physical pole that never gets.
Yes, that's right. The physical poles are there. That's exactly what we're coming to. First, I'm going to say it rather algebraically, and then I will say it. Then I'll say it geometrically. I do it this way because both of these ways of thinking about things have merit. And actually, this more algebraic way, at the moment, as we understand, generalizes to everything. The more geometric way, we have not yet generalized to everything, and is despite 6 months work, there's clearly some idea needed to do it, but I strongly suspect that some generalization exists. But let's talk about both of them. Let's talk about them in this case. First, let's think a little more algebraically. So more algebraic geometric picture. You see, I don't use the terminology capriciously for a reason that you'll see in a sec. So in this case, we saw that there was a six-term identity between these different objects. Okay, that's actually, there's a general six-term identity of that form that I can derive in exactly the way I derived this one. Let me start with a one-dimensional integral where I pick any six guys. One over GL1. This is a one-dimensional integral. Just like before, I sum over all of its residues. I get a Cauchy's theorem that says that everything adds up to zero. Okay. So that means that these R invariants satisfy a six-term identity. Which can be written as A, B, C, D, E, plus B, C, D, E, F, plus C, D, E, F, G, plus G, A, B, C, D, equals zero. Okay? You pick any six guys, and you sum over all six of them, deleting one, and that's equal to zero. Okay? Did I not write the... Oh, sorry, I should have... Thank you. C, D, E, F, A. Thank you. Yeah, there are no seven-term identities, alas. Not in CP3, anyway. And the last one is F, A, B, C, D. That's why I should use numbers and not letters. Okay? All right. Now, that means that if someone hands you two different objects, two different sums of these R invariants, right? They might look visually different, but on the support of those six-term identities, they might actually be equal to each other, right? So it'd be nice to come up with some systematic way of checking whether two things are actually equal to each other on the support of that identity. So it's a totally trivial little linear algebra problem, right? I hand you one set, I hand you another set, how do I know? And it might be non-trivial, because there might be tons and tons of combinations of these guys. How do you know that the two of them are equal to each other? Okay? Or said another way, you can think of equivalence classes of these sums of the R invariants. Now we're starting to think about things that sound like chains, okay? Which differ from each other by adding any of those six-term identities. We're trying to figure out how to classify the equivalence class. All right, well, this is very simple to do when you have a small geometric insight. This identity, just formally, now completely forget about these as functions, you know, they're just these things that satisfy these anti-symmetry properties. That's it. The function comes at the very end when we evaluate it, but from now on, this is the fact that they're totally anti-symmetric and they satisfy this identity is all that's going to matter. This is this combinatorial feature that I keep alluding to. This six-term identity can be written as a statement that the boundary of some five simplex is equal to zero. The boundary is just a standard notion of boundary. If you think of it as a five simplex, you delete one vertex at a time, and you get... So now, if we visually think of this as some five simplex, well, then we just sum over all of the all of its four simplices in its boundary. Okay. So now, how can we tell if I have two expressions, expression one and expression two? How can we tell if expression one is equal to expression two plus a bunch of these identities? Well, if expression 1 is equal to expression 2 plus a bunch of those identities, E1 equals E2 plus the boundary of something. And because this boundary is the good old-fashioned boundary we know and love and squares to 0, that means that the invariant content is that the boundary of E1 is that the boundaries are equal to each other. So this form is not invariant, as we know very well. We can have lots of different BCFW representations. But there is something which is invariant. This is like the gauge field, but the F mu nu is the boundary. And it's the boundary that contains the physical content. Okay? Now. Let me ignore that for the moment. It's very easy to prove, but let me just keep going. Of course you're right, but it's a minimally necessary condition, obviously, but it's of course also sufficient. Okay. All right, so actually, let's just take a look at what the boundary, just formally, what is the boundary of an R invariant? Again, forget about it as a function. Just formally, well, this is just all the four faces, right? All the three simplices plus B, C, D, E plus... Plus all five of them, right? just deleting one at a time again. Now, note just formally for the moment, and in a second this is going to become very, very vivid, but note formally at least that the boundary of this thing is in one-to-one correspondence with all the poles that it has. Remember, the poles of this object are all these four brackets downstairs. So the boundaries, just formally, the boundaries of this thing is in one-to-one correspondence with all the poles of this R invariant. This is not an accident, for a reason that'll become clear. Okay. So now let's go ahead and see what the boundary of the tree amplitude looks like. Right? I gave you this formula that M, the sum of 1 I, I plus 1, j, j plus 1. So what is the boundary of M? The boundary of M is the sum over I and j. Well, let's just do it dumbly. I plus 1, j, j plus 1, minus 1, I plus 1, j, j plus 1, plus 1, I, j, j plus 1, minus 1, I plus 1, j plus 1, plus 1, I plus 1, j. I'll just do this, and then I'll just be another 5 minutes, and then we can take a tea break. Okay. So this is what the boundary looks like. Now notice, this term cancels that term telescopically in the sum over I. That term cancels that term telescopically in the sum over j. So the boundary is nothing other than the sum over ij of I plus 1, jj plus 1. Namely, the democratic sum over all the physical poles. In fact, you can use this boundary calculus to prove a converse. If you want to put any of these guys together in such a way that the boundary only contains physical poles, this is the unique object that does it. How do you prove that? You write down any old boundary of it that you like, and then you take its boundary. Its boundary had better vanish. And so you can very easily show, it's a cute little argument involving drawing some funny diagonal lines, but you can show that the only combination of things that look like I plus 1, JJ plus 1, which satisfy the property that their boundary vanishes, is the democratic sum over all of them. So we're beginning to see just purely combinatorially here, this is what the amplitude is. It's not any particular representation. Those are representations of it. But what it is something whose boundary is a sum over all the physical poles and is this manifestly beautiful cyclic thing. In fact, had we never heard of BCFW, but we had this idea that the boundary was the physical thing, this is another nice, just trivial little boundary calculus exercise you can do to like remind yourself that these things were fun as undergraduates. You can take this boundary and just construct something whose boundary gives you that recursively. And then you immediately get back to a formula that looks like the formula that we wrote. Okay? So I hope you begin to see now why I rhapsodize about the essentially combinatorial nature of these things. These are some objects that want to be put together in an incredibly geometric, simple way. And the physical properties have to do with the way in which they can be glued together. You never once touch an actual expression till the very, very end of the computation. You just end up manipulating and playing with boundaries that look like this. All right, this was a very algebraic argument. Maybe after T, I can come back and tell you a very geometric picture for what this is. That geometric picture will not only make us feel good, but it will also give us a new formula for this amplitude. This is a formula that makes the poles manifest, makes unitarity manifest as possible. This other formula will make locality manifest. And it's really, it's a new formula for this ancient beast that so many people have played with all these years. Amusingly, for the case of six particles, this new formula agrees with one of the famous old Berenson-Kiele forms of the NMHV amplitude. So proving that nothing good is ever wasted in the subject. So Berenson-Kiele is now seen as, as you'll see, as another triangulation of an underlying polytope. But of course, the picture generalizes to all n. All right, great. So let's pick it up after t.
All right, so this isn't going to go on forever. Yeah. So, I just want to say, complete this little picture here, just so you get more feeling for what's going on. Then I want to make some, general comments. I may say a few things about loops that are just general interest that people should hopefully learn in field theory courses of the future. Just general things about loops, and also just computing loops, why they're polylogs, they're sort of the next geometric way of thinking about finite parameter integrals, and to at least give you a picture for why it is that this sort of combinatorial structure that we're seeing for trees and leading singularity should be reflected in the Apollo ones, although that's still conjectural. I think that it's very likely. Anyway, but let's just return here and finish this story. I now want so here we notice that we can think of the residues, these five index objects, right? These residues are these five index objects. They satisfy the six-term identity. And the six-term identity is exactly what you'd expect. If you were to think of these five bracket objects as a four simplex. Right? So that's really what we're doing here. We're geometrically imagining, everything we're doing with them was geometrically imagining that this five object A, B, C, D, E was a four simplex. Right? Like if it was a triangle, it would be A, B, C, it has two simplex. So here we have this A, B, C, D, E is a four simplex. And so all the manipulations we're doing are like saying you're taking these little tetrahedra together. In other words, forget about the numerical value associated with it. We're saying that the amplitude is associated with a picture where you imagine that each one of these arm variants is actually a little tetrahedron in a four-dimensional space. And they're being glued together such that the three-dimensional boundaries of this four-dimensional region are given by the faces ii plus 1, jj plus 1. Okay? Right? So that's really all of our manipulations just suggested that just purely formally. Now I want to show you why, and again, in this very simple case, we can see this all explicitly. Why these words are not just formal. And what I'm going to do is actually show you an actual simplex in an actual four-dimensional space and see that this R invariant is actually the volume of that simplex. And the amplitude will be actually the volume of some polytope, the literal bosonic volume of some polytope. We'll see where the fermionic information comes from.
You have a microphone?
Oh, sorry, I don't have a microphone. Sorry.
I really need a microphone, please.
All right.
So the MHP case is supposed to be the volume of...
It's one. The MHP case is one. Yeah. So it's not big. Yeah. Sorry. Have I not turned it on?
No, we just switched the battery.
Oh, switch the battery. Okay.
It's not actually... just records you from the stereo.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, it's Canon will be used against me in a court of blog. Okay. I should have said in these variables the MHV amplitude was just one.
Now, before doing that, I just want to do a little warm-up with something extremely simple, which is the area of a triangle. Let's think about the area of a triangle. Now, just, you know, a normal triangle. So let's say I give you a triangle, and I give you the coordinates x1, x2, x3. Okay? What is the area of this triangle? Well, it's x1 minus x2 cross x1 minus x3. But I can rewrite that. This area, I can rewrite as just the determinant of this matrix, 1, 1, 1, and then x1, x2, and x3. Right? The determinant of that 3x3 matrix, where I put 1s upstairs. So far, so good? Okay. Now, as many of you know, those of you who weren't here, I really strongly encourage you to look at the lecture Hodges gave here on projective geometry, because thinking projectively is fantastically useful. Once you go projective, you'll never go back. he explained it very, very nicely in his lecture, but anyway it's also a general fact to know. If you've played at all with plane geometry, you also know it's very useful to think about things projectively. So I want to think about this instead of as literally in some two-dimensional plane. I want to think of this projectively as an area of a triangle in RP2, okay? Or CP2. It's all complex. It doesn't matter, okay? So really, I want to imagine that I have three vertices, W1, W2, W3. And now these are homogeneous coordinates, right? So anything I do with them should be invariant under rescaling. All right? And so because that's true, I can always choose some patch where the top component of all of them is 1, right? And then whenever we do this in a projective space, the guys on the bottom you can think of as just being points in a normal two-dimensional space. But thinking projectively is a very big help when we don't have explicit notions of metrics around, as we don't in these examples. Okay, whenever we talk about these volumes, the only tensor in town is the epsilon, symbol. All right, so the formula then. So I need to write down some formula for this guy, which is projectively invariant. So I can only use the epsilon symbol, and it has to be invariant under rescaling via W's. So obviously, it's just epsilon ijk. Okay. But, I mean, I have to remember that there's this reference direction, the direction that I set to be 1, 0, 0. Right? That's picking out, in the projective W space, that's picking out a line in this projective W space. But never mind saying it geometrically. We have some ZA with a lower index, which is this vector 1, 0, 0. Okay, and so this area is also equal to epsilon ijk W1, W2, W3 over W1 dot ZA, W2 dot ZA, W3 dot ZA. Okay, let me rewrite this. W1, W2, W3 over W1 dot A, W2 dot A, W3 dot A. Okay, so you see very nicely this has no, it's totally homogeneous under rescaling 1, 2, and 3. Of course, it's not homogeneous under rescaling A. That's fine because the area has units. Okay, and so the rescaling under A is just giving the area its units. But this is the projective way. So if I hand you now, if I hand you a triangle projectively and I give you its vertices W1, W2, W3, then that's the formula, that's the area of the triangle. So more generally, if I give you, more generally, if I give you a simplex, then that's the volume of the n-1 simplex with vertices W1 to W1. Right? Totally trivial. Now, sometimes you might want to not be given the data in terms of the vertices. Maybe someone hands you the edges of this triangle instead. Okay. So how would you write down the formula if all you were given were the edges? So now this is where, I mean, this is a totally trivial example, but if you haven't played with this sort of projective geometry before, already this is kind of cool, because you very nicely can go back and forth between giving data in terms of vertices and in terms of edges. So if a point in a projective space is specified by giving a W, oh shoot, with an upper index, if this is a point, then a line in a projective space, or in general, an n-1 plane in a projective space is specified by giving something with a lower index. In this case, just a line. And why do we say that? Well, because the linear equation zi wi equals 0, if I specified zi, all the wi that satisfy this equation lie in a plane. And if you choose coordinates where you put a 1 on the top component of the w's, then you can just expand it out. It's exactly the form ax plus by plus cz plus d. It has the constant piece in it. Okay? And that's the power of working projectively. You don't have to make a distinction between the constant pieces and the non-constant pieces in these equations. Okay. All right. So let's say then someone, instead of handing you the vertices, handed you the lines. So there's a line ZA. Let's call that line ZA. So it has a lower index. There's a line ZB. And here's a line ZC. So what's the area of that triangle? Well, we can just use our previous formula. We first have to figure out where the vertices are. So what is that vertex? That vertex is where A and B meet, so it's just ZA, ZB contracted with the epsilon symbol so that it has an upstairs index. That's ZB, ZC contracted with the epsilon symbol so it has an upstairs index. And that's ZC, ZA. So that's again, it's totally trivial, but it's a very nice thing. If you want to know where the intersections are, you just contract things with epsilon symbols. That's it. And then the indices take care of themselves, up and down. All right, so I shove these corners into that formula, and what do I get? I get ABC squared over AAB, ABC, ACA. Okay? So those are two different formulas. This is the same area. Here, when the vertices are given, and here where the edges are given. By the way, you might ask the question, this is a projective picture. So that means that, I mean, I'm here, I know what I mean by the inside. I'm talking about that. What do I mean by the inside projectively, though? I mean, infinity is just, it's just another point. Do I mean this triangle? Do I mean that triangle? That triangle? There's four different triangles in this picture. So which one do I mean? Well, remember, you can now see more clearly A is something with a downstairs index, so A is a line. Okay? So A, so in other words, if I just give you three, if I give you three lines or 3 points, it doesn't matter. This doesn't specify which triangle's area I'm talking about. There's four different triangles here. That's why you need a reference line. You draw a reference line. So there's the reference line A. And you see that that reference line does not intersect only one of these four regions. The region it does not intersect is the one whose area we're computing. That's why you need a reference line to give a notion of the area. Because without it, you don't even know which triangle you're talking about. Okay? So in a projective space, to define an area, you give the appropriate points and you give a reference line. Okay? So let me write a final formula along these lines. This formula we won't need so explicitly, but it's if I ever get to the dialogues, it'll be useful. So another way of writing this area is as follows. Let's stare at this for a second. Okay? So this is literally, I mean, here we just use the, you know, grade four knowledge of triangles to write down the answer. But that's the way of writing the area, just explicitly. Here, I'm saying that I'm doing an integral over the projective space. Okay? To put a measure on the projective, I need to have a measure on the projective space. So remember, what I want is something where if I choose coordinates like 1, w2, w3, the measure should be dw2, dw3 when I fix a gauge like that. But it should be smart enough that if I go to another gauge, like w1, w3, then there it should be dw1, dw3, and so on. So the object which has that property is this. You take w, dw, dw, and you contract them all with the epsilon symbol. And you see that that's exactly the correct thing, right? In this coordinate patch, it's exactly dw2, dw3. In that coordinate patch, it's exactly dw1, dw3, and so on. Okay? So this is the canonical 150-year-old measure on projective spaces. Okay? It's just, instead of dw, dw, it's w, dw, dw, and you contract them all with the epsilon symbol. And so anything that you do with it should have homogeneity 3 in the w's downstairs for everything to have the correct weights. Okay? So I'm just saying I'm integrating over a region in the projective space. The region is defined by giving its faces, in this case the lines ZA, ZB, and ZC, and I'm integrating this form, just 1 over w dot a cubed. This is manifestly the area of the triangle. To see it, just pick those coordinates that I chose before, and this is just dx dy. This just turns into dx dy over the little triangle. Okay?
It's not a contour.
It's just an integral with boundary. It's just an integral with boundary. It's a real integral with boundary. You can deform it to be a contour integral with boundary, of course. It's holomorphic, so it's a contour integral with boundary. It's a multidimensional contour integral with the boundary. But when it's real, it's just literally the area. Okay? It's literally the area. Once again, this makes it vivid again why it is that we need this reference line. First of all, I can't just integrate that. I need something that has a weight. Okay? So I need to have something downstairs. And secondly, once again, this tells me which one of the regions I'm integrating. I'd better not integrate one of the regions that A passes through. Otherwise, this is totally singular and ill-defined. Okay? So what A does is pick out which one of the insides I am talking about and computes the area there. Okay? So this is just a nice way of writing of the same thing as a contour integral with boundary. Yes?
In the case of a triangle, right, if you just give me the edges, I know what to do with them. Where one ends, I just add the other one, you know, and then I get a closed curve. If you give me a bunch of planes, is it clear that there's one?
It's a two-dimensional plane. It's just all living in two dimensions. So yeah, it's just a plane. So it is equally clear. They're just living in a plane. Okay. All right. So let me just already here illustrate in the simplest possible example a point that we'll see for the whole amplitude. Let's say I now have a square. I want to compute the area of the square. Okay? And let's say I give you as data ZA. So let me relabel it. So the line Z1, the line Z2, line Z3, line Z4. Okay? So I want to compute the area of this the area in here. There's two natural ways of computing this area. The first one is to think of it, I need to triangulate it. So the first one, which might not look like the most natural one, but it's the first one that I'll talk about. The first one is to think about this area as the big triangle minus this little triangle. Okay? So if we do that, what do we get? This is very easy to do because we have all the data, right? This big triangle is just something whose sides are 1, 2, and 3. So let me just denote by the symbol ABC, let me just denote that to be ABC squared over AAB ABC ACA, right? Notice this looks very similar to our R invariant. Well, the numerator doesn't have a fermionic part. We'll get back to that in a second, but it looks very, very similar, right? It has the same denominators downstairs, right? Well, so one way I could do this is to take this triangle. So that's the triangle 1, 2, 3, minus that triangle, which is 4, 3, 4, 3, 1. And by antisymmetry, it's the same as 1, 3, 4. Okay? The orientation really works out properly, so it's 1, 2, 3 plus 1, 3, 4. Okay? That's one way of computing the area of that triangle. Another way of computing it is this triangle plus that triangle minus the other one. So this is equal to 2, 3, 4 plus 2, 4, 1. Okay? So you see that our little ABCs satisfy a four-term identity. Four-term identity just says you take a square and you chop it up in two different ways, and you get the same answer. Okay. Or I could have said it even more familiarly. If I take a triangle and I put a point in the middle, it's just the same as that area plus that area plus that area equals that area. Okay, that is a four-term identity. Okay. All right. So this is starting to look. Familiar. In general, we have ABCs, and they satisfy ABC plus BCD plus CDA plus A plus DAB equals 0. And we can think of this as formally being the boundary of some ABCD equals 0. But in this case, it's not just formally. That's just exactly that picture. Okay. So here we have very similar objects to our R invariants. They satisfy four-term identity, not a six-term identity, but they have three rather than five indices. And we see that they satisfy that identity because they really are packed together to build another object. Well, because they're really areas of triangles. So let me immediately write down a formula for the area. Let me write down a formula for the area of a general polygon. If I'm given a general polygon, the area is equal to the sum, well, I can triangulate it with that triangle plus that triangle plus that triangle and so on. Okay? That's a very canonical way of building up the area. So that's a sum over I of 1 I plus 1. Okay? Now, obviously, that's not a cyclically invariant presentation for what it is, because I picked the point. I could triangulate it any other way. But this is one way. So the object is fundamentally this area. It's the area of this polygon. And this is one presentation of it. Okay? Now notice that this presentation has some funny features. Explicitly, this is sum over I, 1 I plus 1 squared over A I plus 1, 1. It has some poles when 1i, a1i is 0, and a1i plus 1 is equal to 0. Those are totally fake old poles. They're not there in the answer. What happens when a1i equals 0? What's going on in this example is like when I have the, that area is blowing up because even though this thing is being kept constant, I'm moving one of these points to infinity, so it's the difference of two infinite areas. Okay? That's fine. So this is a presentation of the answer. What's special about this presentation of the answer is that the triangulation does not introduce any new lines. It introduces new points, but it does not introduce any new lines. And it has the feature it's cyclic. That presentation isn't cyclic. It has spurious poles that cancel in the sum. And all of that is just obvious from the first presentation in terms of just the damn area of the polygon. Okay? All right. Well, there's another way we could compute the area. I can introduce some random point, star. Okay. That point might even be one of these points. It doesn't matter. But I'm just choosing. I could also replace that one by a star, by the way, okay, analogously. Let me actually put it like that. Okay. It can be anything. Okay, so this is some, but that's a line star. This is a point star. So that's a Z star. This is a W star. And now I'll just triangulate it in this most obvious way. Okay? I mean, I can triangulate hundreds of ways. So what is that formula? So the second formula for the area is equal to the sum over I. Now, what's each one of those triangles? That edge's coordinates is I plus 1, is I minus 1 I. That's I plus 1. Okay? So upstairs, I just have the contraction. So these are my three W's. One of them is W star. The other one is I minus 1 I. The other one is I plus 1. And I have downstairs A dot W star. A I minus 1 I. A I plus 1. Okay? And we can actually simplify this to just be W star I minus 1, I plus 1 over A W star A I minus 1, I A I plus 1. All right, so this is a second formula, different triangulation of the same polygon, which makes different things manifest. This triangulation introduces a new lines, not new points. It's an internal rather than an external. If you like, I have a polygon. I have it in the original space. I can draw it in its dual space. And I can triangulate it naturally in one space or the other space. Okay? This triangulation is manifestly local. Local in the sense that all of its poles are the ones that the actual polygon has. It's when I minus 1i and ii plus 1 become collinear, which is when this polygon stretches out and becomes infinitely big. Okay? Now, already this is a totally trivial example, right? But this is already a non-trivial identity. If I hand you that identity, ask you to prove that the left-hand side equals the right-hand side, it's not easy, just algebraically. If you didn't know what they were, it's not easy algebraically. You'd be shouting for a long time. It's not that bad in this case, but it's still not totally obvious. But I think you agree that that clearly we have the invariant picture, area of polygon, and then we have different triangulations of it, which make different properties manifest. Okay? Yes?
Do I understand correctly that this choice of triangulation which eliminates the spurious poles?
Yes, this is manifestly local. Of course, these aren't amplitudes, but it's local in the sense that the poles are exactly the poles the answer has. Okay? And it only involves these consecutive guys. So
these are possible.
For NMHV amplitudes, for the real thing we're going to do it now, in the general case, what I can say is that we have a fairly good understanding. I mean, first of all, we know the answer. We know all the residues. We can identify them all as all residues in this Grassmannian. They have an interpretation in terms of, you see, there's a polygon here and there's a polygon here. They're dual polygons to each other. This form is triangulating the polygon in one form. This form is triangulating it in another form. Okay? When I generalize this to NMHV in a second, you'll see it's the identical story. Okay? Absolutely identical story. And so there's a polygon that lives in a projective space. The curious fact is it lives in CP4 and it's bosonic. That's an interesting little fact we'll have to just talk about in a second. But still, there is a nice bosonic, polytope. And we know what it is in one form whose triangulation is associated with BCFW. And then I'll show you another form whose triangular association with a local form, which is free of spurious poles. What we know in general is the analog of this polytope for the BCFW form. What we don't know in general is the analog for the local form. So this is, I've said it like five times, this is, I think, a very big, either it's not possible, which I strongly doubt, there's some idea missing. And the idea that's missing is that it's a more non-abelian version notion of volume somehow. It's not literally taking something and chopping it up. You see, in these cases, we can chop them up anyway and reassemble in any way we like. This notion of volume, in the general case, has an order associated with it, which is.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We've got a talk until 5.
Okay.
And we probably definitely need to be setting up by 4:30.
Okay.
Okay. Thank
you. That's fine. Great. All right. I'll be done. All right. So then maybe I'll just very very quickly tell you the analog. Okay. So just to. Sorry. And notice that, what about the boundary operation? The boundary is literally saying, if you hand me a bunch of these triangles and put them together, how do I know if two of them are equal to each other? Well, if they have the same boundary, okay? And so that's it, right? So if we do the same thing, we do the sum of 1i, I plus 1. If we take its boundary, it's just equal to the sum of i plus 1, okay? It's just exactly the outside. And furthermore, in this case, it's trivial to see that the only combination of these ii plus 1s, which can be the boundary of something, is that one. Obviously, because any other one has edges. So all of the things that I told you about the NMHV amplitude are manifest in this little example. Okay. Now, to finish the story, let me just and tell you how it connects to the NMHV amplitude. Let me just write this down again. So this is a delta 4 of a phi A B C D E plus cyclic over all the 4 brackets. And so we already see that it wants to be thought of as something as a simplex, a four-dimensional simplex. It lives in a four-dimensional projective space. The trouble is that bosonically, the bosonic variables here live in CP3. There doesn't seem to be enough room. Okay. Well, there's a very easy way around that, which has an interesting impact on supersymmetry, which I'll mention quickly. But is to imagine making some new bosonic variable ZA that has the Z's bosonic components up there, the three of them, but takes the fermionic component of this guy, phi A, and dots it into some, so this has some spinner index A, R symmetry index A that runs from 1 to 4. So we had four of them. So we build this funny nonlinear object. Okay? Its top component is the bosonic Z, and the bottom component is psi dot phi. Immediately, there's something cool about this. I should have emphasized something. Those R invariants that I wrote down are the unique superconformal invariants. That's what we saw, right? Not only are they unique, they're unique Yangian invariants, but never mind Yangian, just superconformal invariants. Okay? So you notice something really fascinating. The superconformal invariants are not manifestly local.
You said that they were unique superconformal?
Yeah, in fact, in this case, even if you never knew about the Yangian symmetry at all, if you just want to write down superconformal invariants, remember I told you the integral for NMHV, for k equals 1.
In that case,
just superconformal invariants all by itself implies the Yangian invariants and everything else. And that's because the Grassmannian in this case is just the projective space, and there's a unique measure on it no matter what. So those objects, I mean, they're canonical as hell, okay? But they're really tightly tied to the supersymmetry. So it's fascinating that supersymmetry and locality are in tremendous tension with each other. Okay? This is something we see over and over again, right? As I mentioned already, the reason we don't have an n equals 4 superspace is because maximal supersymmetry and locality are in tremendous tension with each other. So we see it here. Supersymmetry and locality are in great tension with each other. There's no formula you will ever write down that will be manifestly local and manifestly supersymmetric. Okay? So they're just in tremendous conflict with each other. That's what's so fascinating about these variables, because supersymmetry acts on these things in a totally unobvious way. Supersymmetry will be mangled in a manifest way in this presentation. But now let me tell you what I'm going to do with them. Okay? The psi are just the four new things that I'm introducing out of the blue. Okay? But now I'm going, it's possible to derive this starting from the Grassmannian integral and doing various Fourier transforms. It's a sort of a trivial derivation, but let me just jump to the, because I have 10 minutes, let me jump to the bottom line. Okay? Imagine taking those, now imagine thinking of this as a completely bosonic object. That last component is bosonic, right? Now compute the volume associated with the simplex that has those faces. So what would the volume be? The volume made of the faces Z1 up to Z5 would just be, and I'll write something like this. This is a 5 bracket instead of a 4 bracket. It's Z1 up to Z5 to the fourth over, and I always need this auxiliary guy that I called before A. So here I'll call it A Z1 up to Z4 up to A Z4, Z1, Z2, Z3. Okay? That's what the volume is. Now, I should clearly choose A. You see, the problem has now introduced an artificial SL5 symmetry that isn't there. We only have an SL4. So let me introduce an A. Let me just make sure that A just preserves that SL4. Okay? All right, so what is this? Well, the denominators are trivial now. The denominators are just the normal four brackets, just 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 5, 1, 2, 3. But the numerator is more interesting. This determinant is the determinant of this matrix, which is upstairs Z1 up to Z5, and this is psi dot phi 1 to psi dot phi 5. Okay? So if I take that determinant, it's like psi dot phi 1 times the determinant of the other ones, 2, 3, 4, 5, plus cyclic. That's the determinant, and I'm taking the whole thing to the fourth. Okay? So that's the volume. That's a bosonic volume made out of these bosonic variables Z1 to Z5 that now live in CP4. But the R invariant is just the psi integral of the subject. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is just d4 psi of the volume z1, z2, z3, z4, z5. But the psi to the fourth component of this is nothing other than phi 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plus cyclic to the fourth, which is just delta 4, fermionically, delta 4 of exactly the same object.
Psi 1 now, or
psi for all? No, there's only one psi. There's one psi for everybody. It's a universal psi. It
doesn't
have an index. That's right. It doesn't have an index. So this is the promise relationship. The R invariant is a volume. Well, it's a volume in this one higher dimensional space, treating supersymmetry in that. In exactly in the way I told you. But you can literally imagine a simplex now living in four dimensions. Because it's d4 psi, any additive structure, any properties I have for these volumes are trivially inherited by the R invariant under the d4 psi integral. So I can really think of them as volumes. Okay. And so there's a reason why the boundaries corresponded to the poles, because they really are the poles. That really is where. In exactly the same way as happened in our trivial polygon example. Okay. So that's the MHV amplitude. That's the NMHV amplitude. So I can write the NMHV amplitude as the d4 psi integral of the volume of some polytope, right? The volume of the polytope, what you might call Pn, where Pn is just as a simplex is the sum of now 1 i plus 1 j j plus 1. And since it's the volume, just like in this example, it's the area, what all that matters is the boundary. All that matters is what the boundary of this polytope looks like, which was, as we said, the sum of ii plus 1, j, j plus 1. Okay? And so you can literally, if you want to be fancy, you can write it as d4 psi of this integral w, dw, 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 dw over w dot a to the fifth over this polytope P. Okay. Now, the cool thing that I don't have time to show you is what this polytope looks like, because this is a much more interesting looking object. So in the case where you just have a polygon, we're familiar with the polygon. This is something much cooler looking. Yes.
What is my intuition supposed to be about A not intersecting when I have this funny?
It's exactly the same.
Object built out of
it's exactly the same thing. No. I mean, so we just think of it.
Of that as a bosonic variable.
Yeah, we just think of it as a bosonic variable until the very end. Yeah, and then So. Anyway, so I don't have time to do it. Well, we drew the pictures in our paper from December on this. But what I want to point out is that this is one triangulation of this object is the BCFW form. But once you see the polytope, you see there's another triangulation of it. The way to see the other triangulation is to look at the dual of the polytope, draw the dual of the polytope, and triangulate in the dual space. And that gives you a new formula, as I said, which is manifestly local. So this is, I think, this is the case for NMHV amplitudes. And so there's one invariant object. You chop it up in the original space, it gives you a BCFW form, makes unitarity manifest. You chop it up in another way, it gives you a new local form, makes locality manifest. turns out we can do exactly the same thing for the MHV one loop integrand. It has exactly the same structure. In fact, it's almost the same polytope. And it's essentially the same polytope. You have to interpret it slightly differently, but it's the same combinatorial, exactly the same combinatorial structure. And this manifests a fact that I mentioned in an early lecture, that difficulty in this business is not the naive one. If you ask most people, they would think that difficulty is N and L, number of particles and number of loops. That's not the correct axis of difficulty in this business. The correct axis of difficulty has nothing to do with N. In fact, N equals infinity is the best. Because we've seen this over and over again. I should say, why do we suspect that some? I keep telling you that. Let me say things in order. I'm rushing. So the axis is actually this direction. So k equals 1, l equals 0. That's NMHV tree, and k equals 0, l equals 1 is MHV one loop. They're the same thing. Okay? In fact, in a specific sense, this is the most complicated object, and then you lose information as you go down. Okay? So the next hardest things are k equals 2, n squared MHV, and then MHV one loop, and n squared MHV two loops. Okay? Now, of course, we know all of these guys, right? We have some explicit formulas for them. So, and the way the all-loop recursion works is exactly like that. You start with this object. If you want to get the MHV two-loop amplitude, you have to start from the n squared MHV amplitude. Then you remove some particles. You remove some more particles to get down this way. This is the true. So these are the axes of equal difficulty. If anything, it seems to get simpler. You lose information as you go down in this direction. So what am I complaining about? We have all of this. We know all the tree amplitudes. We have the integrand. We have all of this stuff. So, if all you wanted was some compact formula for the integrand that you could stick on your computer and stare at, that's done for n equals 4. Over. Okay. But that's not why we're in this business. We don't really give a rat's ass about n equals 4 per se. We think there's some sort of more spectacular physical structure lurking underneath it. And these kinds of pictures are what we're really after, right? I mean, if there's some, this clearly seems like a deeper characterization of what it is. You're sort of invariantly characterizing what it is and then computing it in different ways to make different things obvious. Okay, so. This is why there's still a lot to be understood in the structure, even of tree amplitudes. A huge amount still left to be understood in the structure of tree amplitudes. A kind of proof is, can you come up with a formula that's manifestly local? Right? I mean, a year ago I would have thought that Feynman diagrams made locality obvious, so you would never get a simple formula that was manifestly local. But that's not true. Feynman diagrams make both things obvious, locality and unitarity obvious, so it leaves open the possibility that you can find formulas that make one or the other manifest that are very simple. And this is what we're seeing also very explicitly in these pictures. So while we understand the sort of unitarity direction up here and at the level of the integrand down there very well in the sense of having just an explicit formula, a recursive formula for the whole thing, we're still missing the geometric picture. It's like we have all of these, it's like someone handed you all these little triangles and didn't tell you that they got them from chopping up a polygon. They said, I guarantee you'll get the right answer. If you add up all those triangles together, you'll get the right answer. Okay? But it's clearly not satisfying until you know that the polygon that they're building up. Okay? At the moment, it's only for k equals 1. Now, why do we suspect that it's possible? One reason is that we found these remarkably simple expressions for the integrand for two-loop MHV, NMHV, three-loop MHV, these one-term, two-term objects. Those were written in a manifestly local form. That was not the form that was spat out from the all-loop recursion, which was a BCFW-like form. And we just guessed those forms. I mean, well, once you write down these sort of momentum pastoral integrals, there are not that many things that you can write down that are natural. So it wasn't so hard to guess them. But there's no straight derivation of them. And yet they exist. So it's very hard to believe that such strikingly simple formulas exist without some direct way of getting them. And they look very, very similar, very, very similar. I didn't write down the explicit formula, the local formula for the NMHV. It looks almost identical to the BCFW formula. It has almost the same number of terms, very similar structure. It has four poles, local poles instead of five. It has a numerator that you would never in a million years guess unless you had this CP4 picture for where it was coming from. But anyway, we strongly suspect that should generalize. I didn't have any time to tell you about the sort of beautiful geometric organization of all of these objects. So that's that'll have to be left for a private discussion for anyone who's interested. But I do hope you got a flavor for the sorts, even at this very simple level, for the sorts of things that are going on. When you stare at these formulas, it's about as far from a trace negative a quarter f mu nu squared as you could imagine. And yet, these are gluons. These structures are there in good old-fashioned gluon scattering amplitudes. Let me mention just one thing very, very rapidly about gravity, and then I'll quit before we get cut off. Actually, maybe I'll say an even quicker thing about polylogs. So you see that here the amplitudes are associated with integrals of nice forms with poles, high degree poles, over a simplex. Okay? Polylogs are integrals of a nice form with many poles, not high order poles, but with many poles over simplices. Okay? And Feynman parameter integrals, even though we normally write them down as integral ax plus b1 minus x squared in the denominator, Feynman parameter integrals are actually also integrals over projective spaces. In fact, the usual formula, 1 over denominator 1, denominator 2 over denominator n, this you can interpret as, this you can interpret as a volume of a simplex. You can interpret this actually as that formula W1 up to Wn of the W1 dot A, W2 dot A, up to Wn dot A. If you make the vector A be D1 up to Dn, and W1 be 1, 0, 0, W2 be 0, 1, 0, and so on, Wn be 0, 0, 1. Okay? So the Feynman trick is really writing this as the integral W dW dW over W dot A to the n. Remember, that's that W dot A to the n that we had over this simplex, whose now corners are given by whose corners are given by the W's. Okay. So a Feynman parameter integral is actually an integral over a simplex. This is a really convenient and powerful way of thinking. Because, for example, the usual formulas just correspond to choosing various gauges where you put some of the points at infinity. So you can get expressions where it looks like an integral over a quadrant or an integral over a compact region. That's just different ways of presenting the same projective triangle. Okay? But this way of thinking about it is very powerful because it allows you to see the sort of geometry in the answer in a very transparent way. For example, a Tuft in the late 70s computed, just to give you an example, computed a completely general one-loop integral, totally general one-loop integral with general masses inside and general momenta outside. This was like a very tough computation expressed in terms of, I'll just be, just one moment. Just expressed in terms of something of 12 dialog rhythms. But in this picture, it's in the associated Feynman parameter integral after you finish it is an integral. The Feynman parameter integral is an integral over a three-dimensional projective space with a general quadric and over a simplex. And the dialog rhythm is actually associated with this picture. You draw the simplex, you draw the quadric, and each one of the edges of the simplex intersects the quadric in two points. It has these two edges. You build the cross ratio out of those points, and that's the first argument in the symbol of the dialog rhythm of the answer. The second argument is exactly the same thing with the dual of this picture. Okay? Absolutely gorgeous result derived by Goncharov. And you would never think of it. I mean, when you stare at the Feynman parameter, you never think of it that way. You never even think to look at these quadrics and the lines and the triangles and all that stuff. But when you think of it projectively, you do. Okay? And Goncharov generalizes to any number of dimensions, which gives the answer for the totally general box integral, hexagon, higher integral, in any number of dimensions that Mark Anasia wrote a very, very beautiful paper recently using. Okay? But these things are just obvious when you look at them. I mean, the right variables, what the answers look like, are just obvious when you think about them projectively. And so I just want you to notice that, and this is why the polylogs have combinatorial relations, because they satisfy relations of exactly the same sort. You take this region, you break this region up into two pieces, you break it up into different ways, and you get lots of linear relations between these polylogs. Okay? The story of the polylogs and the story of the polytopes that we're talking about are incredibly similar to each other. And in fact, the general theory for polylogs that Goncharov has been developing for the past 15 years, the most beautiful object is thought of not as an integral over a simplex in a projective space, but as an integral over a particular part of the Grassmannian. I haven't had any time to tell you about it, but that, of course, is a part of the Grassmannian that is intimately related to all of these this geometric polytope story that I had zero time to tell you about. So these things are just enmeshed. It really looks like the story of the polylogs is a reflection of a basic story that we're seeing already at the level of the tree amplitudes. All right. My 30-second comment about gravity, because Steve will kill me if I don't say it, is that the situation with gravity is very poor compared to gauge theory in many ways. And to me, the most vivid thing of all is that while there are beautiful formulas, we can use BCFW, we can use BCJ, there's lots of spectacular progress. There is not a formula for gravity amplitudes, even for MHV amplitudes, that fits in your head. The Park-Taylor formula fits in your head. You can remember it if someone wakes you up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Okay? The gravity amplitudes do not fit in your head. I mean, an explicit formula for them, a dead explicit formula for them, do not fit in your head. And something that's particularly troubling to me is that there's no formula for gravity amplitudes, even MHV amplitudes, that makes an incredibly basic property of them manifest, which is that they should be fully permutation invariant in all the external legs. The best we have is a formula, a 10-year-old formula due to Zvi and friends, rediscovered by Mark Anasia and Konkal, I guess, that manifests in SN minus 2 symmetry, but not something that's fully permutation invariant. And just to finish, here's what the formulas for gravity are that do fit in your head for 4 and 5 particles. Okay? But just to illustrate what the source of the difficulty is. So we can factor out, this is for the MHV amplitudes, we can factor out the product of all the angle brackets. So those are all the poles that you're allowed to have for MHV amplitudes. So what's left is the following object. For 4 particles, the object is 1, 2 over angle bracket 3, 4. It's kind of crappy, non-permutation invariant looking object, which is, of course, for 4 particles, permutation invariant because of momentum conservation. Okay? This thing is permutation invariant on the support of momentum conservation, trivial exercise. Okay? For 5 particles, it also fits in your head. It looks like 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1, minus the other way around. Okay. That's much worse looking. It doesn't even involve particle 5. You can write it another way as trace gamma 5, p1 slash, p2 slash, p3 slash, p4 slash. Okay. And this is also a permutation invariant on the support of momentum conservation. Okay? Because you see, I can trade p4 for p5 using momentum conservation. All the ones that are anything that involve 1, 2, and 3 give me 0 because of the slashes, and so it's permutation invariant. But it's only permutation invariant on the support of momentum conservation. This actually has a nice geometric picture. If you imagine drawing the 5 momentum points, p1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if you just draw them in some in Minkowski space, then this is the volume of the tetrahedron that's made up of those 5 points. Okay? So those 5 points define a 4-dimensional tetrahedron in Minkowski space. Okay? And that's it. I mean, we have the formula. We have the BCFW formula in principle. We have a Drummond and Henn gave us a solution, just like for, just solving the recursion relation for any gravity amplitude, just like for Yang-Mills amplitude, but they don't fit in your head. And already at 6 particles, we don't have something that's that you can just recognize, and it sort of looks obviously gravitational, obviously permutation invariant. There is something missing. There's some idea missing. There's some way. There's some picture for. I mean, in these cases, we recognize visually that these things are permutation invariant. But there's probably some structure there. There's something, very likely, I think, there is some analog of what we saw with the Grassmannian. There's some gauge symmetry, which has to be gauge fixed in different ways in order to let us see the full permutation invariant. But the basic object has some extra gauge symmetry, which is invisible to us. A lot of progress in this business is finding new gauge symmetries. And yeah.
By the way, if you look at the soft factor,
right,
it's got a non-permutation of it, but
yes,
there's actually a variant of it that is permutation.
Right, indeed.
Because of the gauge symmetry.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I was just about to say that. This problem is nicely solved for the soft factor. So we do have beautiful permutation invariant forms for the soft factor. But elevating that, in a sense, the formula you guys wrote down and Mark Anansi wrote down is using the soft factor to maximum advantage. It's building up the MHV amplitude by acting with the inverse of these soft factors, starting with a triangle and just acting with the inverse soft factors in all possible ways, which is why it preserves the SN minus 2 symmetry. But not all of it. Yeah. Anyway, so that's so compared to Yang-Mills, this is the state of the art, at least for its finding pretty formulas. And so anyone take a crack at it. All right, thanks a lot.
How long are you going to be available?
I'm around for a while.
Yeah, till I guess tomorrow, right? So
yeah.
Anyway, people are welcome to talk to Nima.